So if you've never had a good boss, how do you know what good leadership looks like and feels like? And that's why I wrote the book. That's why I do the podcast, because I'm trying to give as many examples of what good leadership looks like and feels like. And you know what? The easiest thing is, it's human. It's coming back to, how would I want to be handled in this situation?
Welcome to the podcast, where we introduce you to incredible humans who share their journeys with the mission to inspire you to harness your own inner tenacity to drive your life and career forward. And now, your host, Adam Posner.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. We're bringing the best and the brightest from the world of business, marketing, and personal growth to help you harness your inner tenacity and drive your career forward. Folks, my guest today on the podcast is Lindsay Dowd, a seasoned business coach with a remarkable 25-year career in sales and leadership at a little company called IBM. And she's also garnered recognition as a top 10 coach by Apple News. This is big. And her passion for reshaping leadership and fostering positive cultures has earned her the 2023 Award for Innovation and Excellence, where she was named Business Coach of the Year. And Lindsay's legacy as an industry leader is underscored by her book, Top Down Culture, Revolutionizing Leadership to Drive Results, solidifying her as a thought leader in leadership development and corporate culture. Let's get into it. I'm going to get the music going a little bit longer. Lindsay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ed. It's so nice to be here.
Well, welcome. And Lindsay is joining us from the great city of Boston in the state of Massachusetts. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm thrilled to have you here, a fellow outlier. We were just chatting about this incredible community created by Scott McGregor. So give Scott some props in that. And just been, it's what it's all about. It's connecting good people and having conversations and just being open to it. And that's another thing we're going to talk about during the show as well, too, because I think that people don't really understand networking and they don't understand what it means. And some people take such a a clinical approach to networking, right? It's not like that. It's about adding value and it's about giving. And we're going to get into it in a little bit. But before we do that, let's hit the rewind button. And I always love to talk about my guest parents. And if you don't mind sharing, I'd love to hear what your parents did for a living, because I think that kind of sets up, it kind of sets up like, how do people get there? Like, my parents are teachers and I'm a recruiter and a podcaster. Like, there's a disconnect.
Yeah.
But the other side is, listen, this podcast is not about me today. Tell us about your parents.
So my mother was a teacher, and she taught, fourth grade, second grade, elementary school, drama, library, all elementary. But she taught at the school she actually went to. So she really brought it full circle. Very cool. And
side note on that, my mom taught at the school she went to also.
Oh, my God. And my sister-in-law did the same thing. So she teaches at the high school that we went to, which is very cool.
And my brother's a guidance counselor at the high school we went to, which is crazy.
Love teachers.
Yay. Full circle, yes.
Props for teachers. And my dad spent 41 years at IBM. So I grew up in that culture. I remember going to 590 Madison at 6 years old and spinning around in the chair saying, I'm going to work here someday.
That's crazy.
And the day I did, it was kind of... So
your dad was in the city and not up in Poughkeepsie, right?
So we grew up in Westchester. So he would take the train in on Metro North, and he had an office on Madison Avenue. He had an office in White Plains. He had one in Valhalla. He bounced around wherever they sent him. And anyone that's been an IBMer is familiar with the company. You stay in a job about 2 to 3 years and then you move on to something else. So the one caveat my mother said to him was, you know, the joke was IBM stood for I've been moved. And my mother said, I will not be moved. So we are not going to Dallas. We are not going to Poughkeepsie. We are not going to any of the other amazing places IBM could send you. So this is where we stay. Work it out. So that's what we did.
IBM. And it's one of those, and people don't really do it anymore, right? It's like these lifetime jobs. I think IBM is still, one of those companies where people are there's a lot of, even in this day and age, when people move around, I think the average tenure for white collar jobs is like a little under 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
But IBM, if you get into like a Deloitte, EY, like some of these larger organizations, it's just a wealth of opportunity, a wealth of innovation. And let's talk about it. They're for the most part, they're good to their people, except when you have mass tech layoffs. But you knew you were always going to work at IBM.
Well, and I don't know if I knew. I just I liked the idea of business, and I got a lot of really cool experiences from my dad. So, you know, back in the day, in the 70s and the 80s, I mean, IBM was very much a family-oriented company. We had this branch mentality where you knew everybody's families, that, you know, if you were an employee, your bosses knew your families. You did family things together. We would rent out Rye Playland every May 1st, and the whole New York branch would come, and all the kids would come. We dressed up too, which was, you know, that was just really interesting. There were so many family opportunities, and that I didn't know was unusual. But it created this incredible culture, this incredible, I guess, foundation for people to really appreciate one another and get to know them. And there was so much diversity, which, again, I didn't know it wasn't the norm.
Especially 40 years ago.
But I can remember one of my favorite memories was being really small. It was probably 6 or 7. And I went into 590 Madison. My dad said, "Oh, I want to introduce you to my secretaries." And they had the same name. It was like Barbara and Barbara, or Carol and Carol. I couldn't remember. And he said, "Now, one thing you should know, they're both blind." And I was like, okay, well, whatever. And so he brings me into this room, and there they are with the screen readers, and it's kind of dim. I mean, they don't care if it's bright or whatever. And I walk in, and I hadn't said anything yet. And they turn and they say, "Hi, Lindsay." And I said, "You said they were blind." And they said, "We're not deaf." And I was like, "Oh my God." But what a cool experience for a little kid to see. I saw lots of people in wheelchairs. I saw lots, obviously, blind people. I saw tons of people of color, and this was normal. This was
amazing.
Cool.
And IBM was a real innovator in that space. But you said something which is interesting, and I want to kind of take a left turn for a second here. This concept of family. And I think that's where it came from, when people used to say, "This is my work family," because that's what it was. And I remember that. Listen, I'm no spring chicken. I'm kind of in an interesting place where I'm turning 45 in a month. So I'm in a place where I grew up back in the day. I learned to type on a typewriter, right? My phone was tethered to the wall on a cord.
My dad sold typewriters, Adam, so we had lots of those.
But I also remember what it was like to feel like a work family. And I remember my early jobs, and it really felt like that. It felt like a family.
Yeah.
Where did we go wrong? Why is now calling family a bad word? Because, like, your family can't fire you, all the layoffs. Like, why? Like, how do we get back to that? Because I like that feeling. I don't know if family's the right word.
Well,
and that's part of the culture.
Funny. I have a sad story about that word. And this was another leader at IBM, but this is when I was working there. And what he meant by family was, "You are going to hire my son."
Nepotism.
You know, we're family. We take care of each other. You don't have a choice, essentially. And that was an abuse of power. And what I grew up in sales, and so did my dad. And by the way, my family put in 105 years at IBM. So we weren't the only two. My husband was there. His father was there. His mother was there. So we grew up very similarly. And, you know, he had branch stuff in New Jersey. I had branch stuff in New York. This is just what we knew. And neither of us like planned to end up at IBM. We came in through an acquisition, but family is dictated by the leaders. And, you know, I wrote this book, Top Down Culture, and I talk about modeling culture from the top. And when you behave like you care, and when you demonstrate interest, and you demonstrate, you know, earnest, "I want to know you. I want to meet you where you are. And how can I be the best leader for you?" Those family moments do actually materialize. Right. And that culture can be recreated. It doesn't have to be the ugly family that I described a moment ago. It can totally be, "I see you, we're connected, we're more than just a person who's doing a job." And that was one thing I really tried to build for my own teams.
I love that back end story. Do you think we lost a lot of that love and feeling because of the pandemic?
No, I think it was lost long before that. I think—
Where'd we go wrong?
Well, I think, leadership became this authoritarian, "I'm your boss, you should respect me." And especially in tech, which was very male dominated. I was always one of the only women on a team for years and years and years. And it wasn't until the end of my time at IBM that I actually had like 4 female managers in a row. But, you know, we had this, if you kind of go way back in history, of your job was a punch card. You came in, you did your job, just do your job. That's all I'm asking you to do. Focus on that and get it done. And you saw kind of this automaton culture of just get your job done and leave. And we lost a lot of that humanity because people wanted to produce more. They wanted bigger results. They wanted faster engagement and faster, you know, sales. And people kind of got away from leading with heart. And, you know, if you just do your job and you just hit your number and you just, you know, the pressure kind of overwhelms the good feelings. And leaders really lost track of that. And then we have the pandemic. And the pandemic actually brought us back to the good. And I'll tell you why. We had the Great Resignation. And the Great Resignation was this big fat moment of people saying, I'm not putting up with this.
I'm done with that. No, I'm
out. This is BS. I deserve better. And I don't want to be talked to this way. And I don't want to have, you know, to have to be on calls for 12 hours a day. Like, I deserve more. And so all these people left their jobs in droves and they just said enough. And so all of a sudden, all these companies got this signal that we've been doing it wrong. We got to get back to some level of humanity or we're going to keep losing our people. And some companies got it. Some companies swung the other way with the great layoff. And the great layoff made the pendulum swing back and put the power back in the companies. And then you saw all those DEI teams be decimated.
You saw a lot
of the really important roles
that
keep the heart in business disappear.
Right. And it's such a fallacy too when they cut what they consider a non-revenue generating piece of the business when it comes to HR, diversity, talent, recruiting. Those are your people, are your lifeblood. And you hit the nail on the head, Lindsay, where the companies that get it, got it. Right.
Yeah.
And I call it the great recalibration. Right. We went to the resignation.
I called it the great reset.
Because we're getting back to it one way or another. And the companies that aren't seeing things clearly, the ones that aren't doing things the right way, are the ones that are going to suffer. And it is what it is. Like, eat or be eaten. And you know what? That's it. And the ones that believe in their people and do things the right way. And we've seen that. I mean, look at the Wayfair example from like a couple of weeks ago. You know, it's horrific. And the way he responded, like, listen, companies will make mistakes. And there is no easy way to do mass layoffs because you have to be able to communicate something to a large amount of people in a short amount of time. And there's going to be inhumanity, right? There's going to be some abrasiveness.
Well, I brought that up because I mean, some people think, oh, she, you know, her company is Heartbeat for Hire. She calls herself a chief heartbeat officer. It's roses. It's rainbows. Okay, guys, the reason you lead with heart is because when you have to deliver those tough messages, and every leader does,
it's part of the job.
It is easier to handle when you are hearing it from someone who genuinely cares about you and who genuinely cares about your well-being. And I will tell you, one thing I never wanted to get good at was layoffs. And it was the most nerve-wracking. I never slept. I hated it.
You're changing someone's life.
And not a good way.
No.
And when you are consistent and you lead with heart, those messages land differently. And I'm going to tell you, a lot of the people that I had to lay off are still in my world today. They are still people that love what I do, love who I am, and recognize this wasn't my choice. I didn't want to have to do it, but I stood by them. I said I'd write them recommendations, and I did. And I watched them launch into their next chapter. But I think that's the thing people have to remember. Of course, you're going to have to do the hard stuff. But when you do it the right way to begin with, and you lead how you want to be led, the hard stuff comes a little easier.
Amen. And anybody obviously familiar with my story, I mean, this is the origin of it. You know, when I got let go from Vayner and could have been just pull off the Band-Aid, get the hell out. But no, it was with heart. And someone I adore, who I assume you know, Claude Silver, Chief Heart Officer over at Vayner, who's one of my mentors and someone super close to me.
Yeah.
It's with compassion and it's humanity. Yeah. And I think we need to bring that back. Even in a mass layoff, there has to be better ways to do it. But I want to close the chapter on IBM for a second there. Was it a tough decision to leave or was the time just ready?
Yeah. I mean, think about this. 105 years from my family, everyone thought I would die there. and the whole the whole thing, the whole reason you stay for 23 years is the people. I mean, I didn't do one job for 23 years. I started in customer service and left as an executive. So, you know, when I left, I wasn't in love with some of the decisions they were making, and I just knew it was time. So I was sought out by another company, and I said, okay, I'm going to go. And it's new. It's going to be challenging, but I'm a maverick. I'm a hustler. I've led first of a kind businesses before. I'm going to run a sales team. I know how to do this. Adam, in 6 months, they fired me.
What happened?
It was the biggest gut punch. It was the most devastating.
Like, you're firing me? I've never been fired before. You're firing me?
It wasn't part of my plan.
I've been for 23 years. I left there to come here, and now you're firing me for six months? That's a spit in the bucket compared to my time. I can't even imagine that. What happened?
So what it turned out, the leader that I was reporting to had very, very low EQ. Mm. She
did you feel threatened? By you?
I think for sure. She wanted an extreme micromanager, which I am so far from. And I'm such a believer of you let your people do the jobs they were hired for. I'm there to remove obstacles. I'm there as your coach. I'm there as your escalation point. Let me help you. Let me find you whatever you need to make you successful. And she wanted me in the weeds on every deal. And it just was not something I wanted to do, not something I was willing to do. And I, you know, there's a reason 25 people were showing up to my 5-person team calls. I mean, I was creating a safe space, but she asked me questions like, why do you care that people like you? I'm like, what do you mean?
What kind of question is that? Is there a hidden camera somewhere? Like where?
Yeah, it was tough. And here's the crazy part. As hard as it was, and as anxiety filled as I was, I never would have left. I was never going to quit. And that getting fired was the gift I needed. It was the shove out of the nest. It was what pointed me to my purpose.
Always.
And all the stories I collected in the 25 years of my working career set me up to do this.
Isn't it how crazy how that works? Because in the moment, and I talked about this 1,000 times, in that moment, it's the worst moment. And I know for me, it was the worst moment. In that moment, I was getting let go. I didn't know what to do. I was like, oh my God, what am I? I'm 35. Like, what am I going to do with my life, my career at this point? Yeah. How do I tell people I got fired? Like all these emotions, these terrible things. But then afterwards, and it takes time and everyone's on their own path, you get to the point of like, you know what? That was the best thing that ever could have happened to me because I wouldn't be sitting here where I am now talking to you. How did that decision process go, saying, all right, I'm not going to go back into working for corporate America. I'm going to follow my passion and start my own thing.
Yeah. So it took about a month for me to get up the courage to even talk about it. I was so ashamed. I was so gutted. And, you know, when you're fired, you think you're the only person on earth that's been fired. And now I think we all talk about it a lot more openly than we did before. And I do feel like it's a badge of honor in some ways. And if you're an executive at a high level, you're going to get fired some point. So I took about a month and I was licking my wounds and I asked myself 3 questions. What am I good at? What do I love to do? And how can I help people the most? And I knew how to build modern leaders and I knew how to create irresistible culture that drives results. I had done it. My teams felt it. They performed over and over and over again. And I had a reputation for building places that everyone wanted to be. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take this. I'm going to start my company, Heartbeat for Hire. And I started coaching leaders and C-suites and speaking to companies. And I started a podcast and I wrote a book. And that was all in the last 2 years.
Oh, it's amazing.
So it's, I feel super aligned with my purpose. I will tell you,
good.
I never thought I'd be an entrepreneur. I never thought I'd write a book. I never thought I'd do a podcast. So all this stuff has come from being open and networking like a machine. And it's been highly fulfilling and terrifying all at the same time.
Oh, and that's the joy of being an entrepreneur, the ups and downs, the roller coaster. I mean, I could talk to you for an hour about the last year of my life and how crazy that was. But you said something that I want to kind of go back to a little bit is this idea of being open.
Yeah.
You know, being open, being able to receive. And I'm not getting all like, you know, hippy dippy here, but receiving energy, I think, is something really important. Because if you close yourself off, you're not getting anything. You're not going to be receptive to listening to people, people who care about you, people who want to see you succeed. And folks like yourself, like me, who take a lot of pride in building a network over these years with amazing folks, it's amazing and beautiful to watch people want to help you. But if you're closed off, it's not going to happen. Let's dig in a little bit around this concept of who is coachable. What does it mean to be a good recipient of coaching, and why some people aren't?
Yeah. So, like you, I am a storyteller, and I always, whenever I start my show, the first question I ask is, tell me your story. And I do that when I network too, because it makes them more memorable. It helps me understand their background, you know, the color of which they make their decisions. And, I really love to meet new people. I feel like they have, my network is just on fire right now. I'm getting connected to such incredible people that are, they've become my friends, my referrals, my clients. It's just such a rich landscape of human beings. And unless you're open, you miss all of that. And I think when you're in a corporate job, it's harder to network. You network within your company and you network with your clients or your business partners, but it's more obligatory. And when it's intentional and you have your eyes open and your heart open, it feels totally different. And especially if you're coming at it from, I don't want anything from you. I just want to know who you are. And is there a way I can support you? When you come in it that way, people are like, ah, I'm your biggest fan. Yeah. I want to help. What can I do? And that is so fulfilling to be in that kind of energy wave. But you're right. It's totally energy. It's not hippy dippy.
No,
it is
real.
Modern networking. It's really how business is being done now.
It is. But what about the folks that are introverts? What about, we talk a lot about neurodiversity in this day, especially when we're talking about DEI and B. We talk about neurodiversity, and it's tough for me. Let's give you a prime example. As a recruiter, I do like to feel an energy when I'm talking to a candidate, but I also have to be mindful of biases that some people may not come to the table all energetic because that's not who they are. And I'm not looking for someone to be rah, 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 but I want a sense of level of engagement. But this, what we're doing right now, is not natural for 90% of the people out there. I am an extreme extrovert, and I could do it with anybody, but a lot of people can't.
But you know what? When you start with tell me your story, I've done this before with people who are on the spectrum or people who have Asperger's or people that have other, you know, things that limit the way they communicate. And it's meeting people where they are.
Exactly.
And if you have an understanding of this is what this person is capable of and you give them grace, you get to still understand who they are and their story. And not everybody is the best conversationalist, but when you hear what somebody has done with their life, that's awe inspiring. And you have to come from the place of, I see you and okay, we're not the same, but I still can learn from you. And you're probably way better at me than XYZ. So I just feel like, my mom said something to me when I was in middle school and I never forgot it. She said, always surround yourself with people who make you better.
Always.
And, you know, she meant it at the time as don't pick the wrong friends because there's a lot of dirtbags out there. But it really has carried through for my whole life. And you find the people that inspire you. You ask them for that time. And most people, if you show them, you know them, meaning you've done your homework, you spend a little time getting to know who they are and you say, hey, you inspire me because would you give me 30 minutes? Most people are going to be pretty flattered and they're going to say, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to.
Hey, everybody. I want to talk about a product and platform that I absolutely love and our latest sponsor, Interseller, the prospecting and outreach platform of choice for recruiters and sellers. Whether you're doubling down on business development or recruiting talent, Interseller does all the heavy lifting of finding contact data, automating the email and follow-up process, and syncs all that rich data into 20-plus CRM and ATS platforms. Reach out now and get going on a 2-week free trial and let them know you heard about it from Adam on the podcast today. Check out the link on the website. Appreciate it.
It's about adding value. And for me, it bubbles up to one thing. It's all about karma. It's all about doing the right thing. And I learned how to, I was lucky. Like I had great mentors around me early on and I learned by example. I watched them network I watched them have conversations with folks, yeah. and that kind of really opened up. So what was, you went out on your own, you're an entrepreneur now, Lindsay, what was one of those like, first like, oh shit moments? You're like, all right, here comes a hard lesson learned the hard way about working for yourself.
Well, I think the hardest thing whenever you're working for yourself is spending money on something that doesn't work. And, you know, most people measure their success financially. So it's, I think, becoming a new narrative that financial success is not the only success. But when you spend money on something who, or someone who tells you they're going to do X, Y, Z, and they don't, and you've watched that money just fly out the window.
Oh, yeah.
And you're counting every dollar. Because when you're building your company, it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I invested in myself. I've never done that before. You know, people put me in training. I'd get to do, you know, Harvard, Duke. And
yeah, they're paying
program,
for it.
But I didn't pay for
it's
that.
It's not coming out of your pocket.
No. So, like, wonderful. I could take advantage of it. I loved it. I soaked it in. But when you're on your own dime and travel costs and publishing a book costs and hiring a producer, like all of these things cost money, and not knowing, am I spending it on the right things? I'm taking a risk. I'm taking a chance. And some risks are great and some are not. And it's hard not to beat yourself up when things don't work out. But you have to kind of pick yourself up and move on and say, okay, that's done. I've learned that lesson and let's keep going. I think those lessons are always tough and, you know, they don't end. So as much as you think like, I'm going to be so much smarter and I'm never going to do that again. No, it's going to happen again. And, you know, everyone has the best, a lot of people have the best intentions, but.
And I think it's also about managing your mental well-being, I think, as an entrepreneur, yeah. more than being, because here's a tough thing. Yes, there's stresses. We both work 9 to 5s in corporate America, and but you kind of like, I don't want this to come out the wrong way. You kind of have a safety net of a paycheck. And what I mean by that is, if you have a couple of off days, if you're not your best, you're still going to get that check at the end of the day. If I have an off day, that means something didn't, the chess pieces didn't get moved down the board.
That's right.
Things didn't happen. Right. Things weren't generating in the right way. Like for example, like I started the year off. I had a terrible 2023. I started the year off with some optimism. I had some good leads going. And then I was sick the first 2 weeks of the year and nothing got done. And I was really hard on myself for that. And like, my wife's like, you can't help yourself from getting sick. Like, it just happened.
Well, and you know, my husband's an entrepreneur too. And he left IBM, became a fine carpenter and a general contractor. So, you know, when he's not working, the money's not coming in. So we're constantly talking about scaling and how can he scale so we can go on vacation and not have to worry about that. And we're getting there, but it's a process. And scaling when you're in the services world is hard because you have to trust people.
You have to trust.
You have
to do the same quality as you.
Know that people I'm that are going to wear my company name are people I can count on.
That's interesting too, because I mean, I found that too. At one point I had like almost 15, 20 people working for me a couple of years ago. And that was a hard lesson for me too, is to how to manage quality control and customer service. And what I really tried to teach, I tried to bubble it up, is the concept of managing expectations, you know, under promise, over deliver, over communicate, keep people in the loop. And let me, as you said earlier, Lindsay, let me help you be your best. Let me provide air cover. Let me be a problem solver. Let me take the fight. Let me stand in front of you and take the bullets, right? Like, let me do that for you so you could be your best. And that was like a great lesson learned for me. And it was also a tough one because I was never a good people manager. I didn't know how to be a people manager until I was my own boss and had to manage people where it meant something different to me. I think that was where.
Well, you just hit on something. A lot of people have never had a good boss. Mm-hmm. And so if you've never had a good boss, how do you know what good leadership looks like and feels like? And that's why I wrote the book. That's why I do the podcast, because I'm trying to give as many examples of what good leadership looks like and feels like. And you know what? The easiest thing is it's human. Mm-hmm. It's coming back to, how would I want to be handled in this situation? How can I inspire greatness in people? And it's certainly not by micromanagement. That never inspired anyone.
No, let's talk about diversity. And there's a lot of interesting things going on. And I've seen counterpoints where there was such, and it's crazy to kind of think about it and talk about it openly, but like the negative effects of diversity programs, and it's been like counterproductive. And I see it, and I'm going to have some real talk here for a minute. I talk to a lot of candidates, and I hear like white males are like, it's like opposite day now. It's like, I can't do anything. And I'm like, when I talk to companies, I really try to understand when you tell me diversity, where does that come in the hiring process? Is it ensuring equity and inclusion that everyone has the equal chance to be reviewed, to be submitted? We're posting the job in the right places. Like, where does that come in? And at the end of the day, when you have two candidates in front of you who are in the final round, and let's just say one's a black woman, one's a white male, are you choosing the best candidate out of the two of them, or are you going to make a diversity hire? Like, that's tough. It's real conversations here.
The biggest mistake companies made, so we had this like influx of talent and this massive hiring spree, and all of these DEI teams got really, I mean, invested in and, told this is what we believe. We feel it's so important. This was right on the tails of George Floyd. And, all of these companies were trying to make these very good optical decisions. And what they failed to do was provide training, provide support, and they didn't put people in the right roles.
They did not set them up to succeed. Nope.
They did not. And so you saw all these people out of their depth, not doing the work that they wanted to do because they didn't know how, because they weren't trained right. And this is a generalization, obviously. It wasn't true for everybody. But the vast majority of those DEI efforts didn't go well. And as a result, the company, great layoff, that's the first to go because we didn't see anything good come out of it. So I ask every leader, when you're hiring people, what are you putting in place to support them? And, we talk about culture as a feeling, right? But there's a lot of ways to measure culture. And one of the things I always talk about is, if you have training programs, are you measuring coming out of the training programs, who's getting promoted? Mm. How long are they staying in roles? Because if they're only staying in roles for a short amount of time, you failed. And really looking at those numbers, what are your attrition numbers by manager? Where are your problems? Because if you have people constantly leaving a team,
the problem is
perhaps that's the problem.
It's fascinating. And I've spoken ad nauseum about my definition of culture, but it really is about feeling valued. And what I want to talk about is the other part I always say is having a clear career path. And that comes down to retention, attrition, and it comes down to management, right? Culture is keeping the people there. Now, listen, people are always going to move on. The average tenure, we talked about this earlier, has gone down because sadly, the only way to get decent raises these days is to move jobs every 2 or 3 years. Yeah. And the companies that recognize and want to keep people are rewarding them financially, whether it be
However, people don't quit companies. They quit managers.
Correct.
And as we said before, success is not only measured financially.
It's happiness.
If you do a poll of people, you will see people find it more important to feel recognized, seen, valued, and like they have a purpose than money alone. And people will weight that higher in their decision to go. So I just feel like, a lot of people have figured out if I keep leaving, I'll keep getting more money. And that's probably true. But if leaders are doing the right thing by their people, they won't want to leave.
No.
And one of the things that I love to teach leaders is, and we had this at IBM, and I didn't realize it was something special until I left. And that was called building a culture of advocacy. And we had this ability where you could ask to do an executive interview with a senior leader anywhere in the company. Mm-hmm. And it most of the time, your managers would say, yeah, of course you can go do that. So the benefit of this, first of all, was you're going outside your reporting chain, you're meeting a manager you wouldn't necessarily get to work with, and they're seeing you in a safe space, a place that
they don't know about your performance.
And they're asking, what's your story? What's your deal? Do you know how many jobs I got because of this?
Wow.
At least 3, I think 4, but it was because someone's like, oh my God, you're awesome. I totally want you on my team. And next time I have an opening, I'm coming to you. And one of the times this happened, I had an executive interview with this woman, and turns out she had 5 jobs on her team. And I told her my story, and I said, based on what you heard, is there anything you think I could do on your team? She goes, Lindsay, you're fantastic. Take your pick. What do you want? I'll let you choose.
And I was like, that works.
What? I mean, it was so exciting. So I got to chart my own course with my career path. And that was from having leadership on high saying, this is a good practice. And we're going to allow for people to have access to leaders.
But not everyone's going to take that opportunity. Not everyone's going to be ambitious like that. And the ones who are going to take advantage. Let's talk about the book, Top Down Culture. Yeah. What did you learn about yourself from writing the book, the process of it?
So I was fortunate. I loved working with my publisher, and the process of writing the book was actually very fast. And most people, when you think about writing a book, you have an image of writer's block and over the keyboard and it's going to take me forever. And I joke when people say, how long did it take you to write the book? I said, 25 years. But really, exactly. The whole process, it took 90 days, which is incredible. And lucky for me, I think when I speak, and my publisher knows that. So we did each chapter like a podcast. So she would ask me a question that. And I was like, bleh.
And kind of transcribe it out.
So we transcribed that. The ghostwriter would kind of put it into some kind of reasonable format that I could actually read. But the first time I got my first draft of my first chapter, I was horrified.
Oh my God.
I was like, this is terrible. But the ghostwriter didn't know my voice yet. And he was writing it how I speak. And so it just looked ridiculous. So that took a few minutes for us to kind of get that right. And once we did, it was great. It was smooth sailing. But I'll tell you the most vulnerable thing about writing a book. It's not putting words on paper. It's not having expectations of, you know, people, you know, you need to get the book done by a certain time. The most vulnerable thing about writing a book is when it's released, because your heart and soul is out in the world and people can stomp all over it and you don't know how it's going to be received. And you second guess everything. You question, oh, why did I name that chapter that? You can't go back. I mean, you could, but it costs money. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of have to let it go. And that feeling of once it was released was like, oh my God, it's out there. What are people going to say?
Is it good? And, is it good enough? Right? Like, is it going to be like all this hype and it's crazy?
Yeah.
Lindsay, who's the book for? Who should be picking this book up?
So the book is for aspiring leaders at any level. But I wrote the book with the kind of leader in mind who is already leading an organization. And I wanted to, I have stories peppered throughout the entire book. That's how I teach, is through stories. So there's good stories, tragic stories, funny stories all throughout to illustrate points of this is what works. This is why this approach doesn't work. Don't be that guy. And really it's, I don't want to say a cautionary tale. It's a lot of really hard truths of what bad leadership does and what great leadership does. My friends tell me they sat down and read it in one sitting. It's not this giant tome mm-hmm. that you're going to be like, well, in chapter 13, I have to.
You have to make it readable. You have to make it people want to pick it up and read it. I mean, there's so many quote unquote business and coaching books out there, and you have to find a balance of telling the best ones are the ones telling stories. I mean, for example, we're talking about Matt Higgins, who's going to come on the Outlier Show tomorrow, and his book Burn the Boats. The reason I love it so much is because it's practical stories where he's also shining a light on other people and telling those stories and the examples learned for it. What's next for Lindsay?
Yeah. So, doing a lot more speaking. I just am wrapping my press tour for my book now, which it never really wraps. You continue doing your podcast, you continue doing articles. So lots more speaking, lots more coaching of C-suites. And I've really kind of modified the way that I'm doing that. So really I was lucky enough to pick the brains of about half a dozen CEOs last week and was validating a lot of my practice. And what we all agreed that the most beneficial kind of coaching is really ongoing. You're infused into the fabric of the team, mm-hmm. and you're doing individual, you're doing some group coaching, you're doing some interviews, some observations, some triage. And it's just kind of a relationship that evolves, but your success is their success. So that's the kind of coaching I'm moving towards. So I've done a lot of individual and, some team, but I really am looking forward to kind of making that pivot to really be more the Wendy Rhodes of mm-hmm. Billions, kind of person.
Good analogy.
So that's the goal. But yeah, more of that, and then continuing the podcast and just networking my pants.
Yeah, and tell us about the podcast. What's it called? What's it all about?
Sure. Yeah, the podcast is called the Heartbeat for Hire podcast, and I feature Olympians and Emmy-winning journalists and professional athletes and CEOs, disruptors, philanthropists, authors, actors, and they're sharing their stories of resilience with my lens on leadership and culture. And the reason I have so many athletes on is because they understand what it is to have a coach. Mm-hmm. It's a very easy parallel to draw. Like, great success comes when you have someone who's outside of your head telling you, no, you're capable of this, you can do this, and why couldn't you do this, and challenging you. So I love being able to share those stories. And I think episode 83 aired last week.
Congrats.
So just keep going. And the guest list is phenomenal. We're recorded out through May right now.
There you go. I applaud podcasters because it's hard what we do. And consistency is hard. And 83 is a massive number. Most shows don't get past 7 because people underestimate how hard it is to do it.
Yeah.
Consistently.
I honestly love it. I love it so much. And I think the unexpected joy of it all is these 83 people who have been on my show have become my friends.
And it's a Trojan horse. It's a not so secret of podcasting. It's the best, by far the best networking tool in the entire universe for me.
I agree.
Right now I are connected. We just spend 40 minutes, yes. 41 minutes chatting, and we get to know each other, and it's a conversation, and it opens up business opportunities. And it also helps me, I'm sure you too, and be able to communicate. Be able to express how you're feeling in a business, professional, personal kind of matter. And it's a game. Yeah. It's a game changer. So keep it up. So Lindsay, let's bring it home here. This show is my masterclass. I get to talk to amazing folks like yourself. And it's just a collection. I mean, literally, I tell my audience, I'm like, 315 episodes, free masterclass. You have enough content for the next 2 years straight if you want to listen to it straight through. But Lindsay, what is the single greatest piece of advice you've ever received that you take action on every day?
The single greatest piece of advice, I think it comes down to you're capable of so much more than you think you are. And, you know, I said before in the show that I never thought I'd be an entrepreneur. I never thought I could build a website. I never thought I could do a podcast. I never thought I could write a book. And challenge is good. Growth and comfort do not coexist. And I think anytime people nowadays, when people feel the slightest bit of discomfort, they run. And I think kids especially are dealing with that. And my children are no exception. So I'm like, okay, your hair's not on fire. You can do this. You can get through this. And you're going to be so much better once you do. But I think that it's okay to take risks. And it's okay to have them fail, because you learn the most from failure. It hurts, but
amen.
You're going to survive.
Amen. As Claude Silver says, we have survived 100% of our bad days.
Yes.
Well, she borrowed from somebody, but she said, and it resonates with me.
Give it to Claude. I love her.
And Lindsay, last but not least, you look back on your life, and it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows, and you've had the tough times and those moments when you had to dig down deep and pull yourself up and harness that inner tenacity. And now you sit here with gratitude for this life, this family that you've created, this career, and now where you are at this season, this chapter of your life, giving back and coaching and harnessing your purpose. What keeps you focused? What is your beacon? Lindsay Dowd, what is your North Star in life?
Oh, I mean, my whole raison d'etre, my reason for being is to transform leadership as we know it. I don't want people to go through the same horrific experiences, plural, that I have with bad leaders. And we can do better as humans. We can do better as leaders. And I just feel like if I can leave a legacy, and I leave the world better than when I found it. And when people think about when I'm long gone out of this world, she made the world a better place. That's what I want to be known for.
Love it. Leave this world a better place than we found it. And for me, that's my kids and empowering them to be their best with the lessons. So Lindsay, I want to thank you so much for joining. It's been a fantastic conversation. We could talk for hours, but the data shows me that at about the 45-minute mark is when my listeners are like, I got to go. You could learn more about Lindsay. Visit topdownculture.com. It's linked up on the show notes, and heartbeatforhire.com. Where else could folks find you? Where could they connect? Where could they learn more?
I am on all of the socials except X at Lindsay Dowd, H4H. Very active on LinkedIn. Please connect with me on LinkedIn. I spend a whole lot of time there. Or come join us in the Outlier Project.
Come check it out. And Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us today. If folks listening, if this show resonated with you, leave a message, DM me. Let me know what you think about this specific episode. Reach out to Lindsay. Say, hey, listen to you with Adam on the podcast. You guys know where to find out more, thepodcast.com. Follow us on all the social media channels. Remember, look out for one another, be good to yourself, be better to others, and catch us next week for another great episode of the podcast. Take care, everybody.
Wisdom is forever, but for us, it's time to go. Thank you for joining us. Luckily, we'll be back with our next episode soon, jam-packed with more incredible humans. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and sharing. To join the conversation, search The Podcast on LinkedIn. And to catch up on past episodes and more info, please visit www.thepodcast.com.